very sincere gratitude to all of our special guests, assembled devotees, for so kindly coming this evening to the Purna Festival. The purpose of this festival is not to convert, but to enlighten. The youth of our country are future leaders. Real leadership that leads the world in a direction that can bring true enlightenment and prosperity is based on values and character. It is not based on power and money. The subject that I was asked to speak on today is the power of positive attitude. As our master of ceremonies, Gauranga Prabhu, was introducing the topic, a simple story came to my mind I would like to share with you. Some years ago, a very dear friend of mine made some very serious choices in his life. How they affected him and how they affected others is quite educating. His name is Matsya Avatar Das. He lives near Pisa in Italy. He is an Italian man, a graduate in art. He was a furniture designer by profession and really dedicated himself to the spiritual welfare of others. There was a man who served at the temple in Italy for several years. He was an acquaintance of Matsyavatar, not a family member, person from a very different background, simple man. He was dying of cancer. He had no income, and there was no one in a position to help him. So Matsyavatar was under no pressure, but by his free will, he gave all the expenses for medical attention to this person. And when he was in his last stages, he sent this man with a medical assistant to Vrindavan, where he was surrounded by devotees chanting the names of God in the holy atmosphere of Vrindavan. Matsyavatar Prabhu arranged, managed, and paid for all the expenses so that he could leave this world in a grateful, enlightened state of consciousness in the land of Krishna. Sometime after that, his wife had cancer. She was on her deathbed. Matsyavatar provided all the funds and all the help so that she could live comfortable as possible in a completely spiritual environment. When she was very close to the inevitable time of death, Matsyavatar asked her how I can serve you. Now please remember, he's not a family member, he's not even necessarily a very close friend. But actually, in essence, he was their closest friend. And she said, because I believe in Krishna, I know I will go to Krishna. I know he's waiting for me. She said, I have no fear of death whatsoever. In fact, I'm looking forward to whatever service Krishna has for me after I leave this world. But I do have only one anxiety in my heart. I have a small son. I think he was about 6 years old, or seven. She said, there's no one proper to take care of him. I want him to be a devotee and love Krishna. If I send him away somewhere else, I don't know what will happen to him. This is my only anxiety in life. Matsyavatar said to her, I promise you, I will personally accept your son as my own son. And I vow to you that your son will never think that I'm partial to my old children over him. I will take care of him until he grows up, and if necessary, for his whole life. She trusted his word. She smiled. And she said, now I've taken care of all my responsibilities in life. I'm the happiest person in the world. I'm ready for Krishna to take me whenever he wants to take me. And she left this world in a grateful and happy state with devotees around her chanting the holy names. That's a positive outlook in life. To see death as a wonderful opportunity. To see death as a glorious step forward rather than the bitter inevitable end. Her positive outlook inevitably brought her to Krishna, to life's perfection. And in regard to Matsyavatar, this was some years back. He took care of that child along with his own two children as his own son. In fact, when I would go to his house, if I would talk to his own children, he would very, very concernedly tell me, please, whatever time and energy you talk to my children, spend more with this child. He should never, ever, ever feel a trace that he's less than my own children or that he's loved less. Now the boy's in college and he's very happy, completely protected. And from the point of view of Matsyavatar, taking care of this child, disciplining him when necessary, the whole burden of the finances of paying for his food and paying for his clothing, is paying for his college and his education in the Western world, you may see as a burden. But he does not see it as a burden. It's one of the greatest joys in his life. Because he sees that he's serving a devotee. He sees that he's maintaining his promise and his vow to two wonderful people who he promised at the time of their death. It is a joyful, fulfilling, an enlightening experience for him. Why? Because he has a positive outlook. We are all spirit souls, part of God, according to Gita. And Krishna is Swarat. That means he is completely independent. And as parts of the Supreme Lord, we also have independence. People can take away your money, material nature can take away your health, time will take away your youth. Everything is taken away from us, inevitably. But there's one thing that there is no power in all creation that can take away from anyone in this human form of life. And that is our free will. This is all important. Life is about how we choose to use our free will at every moment. According to how we use our free will, we become conditioned to think that way, to see the world in that way, and to act in that way. Yes? We become conditioned by whatever we associate with. Just gross example. If one uses one's free will to smoke cigarettes, no one can force you to do it. But the association you keep could very severely influence you to do it. When you start, it tastes horrible. But by your free will, you keep doing it until your free will is so much conditioned to surrendering to that experience that you become addicted. And then it practically seems that you don't even have a free will anymore. By this addiction, you're practically being forced and crushed that I have to do it, I have to do it, I must do it, I can't live without it. Alcoholism, same thing. Drug addiction, same thing. You use your free will, you do it enough times, and soon you become so conditioned by the modes of nature that you willingly surrender to that it appears that you've lost your free will. But in fact, you haven't. So whatever our consciousness is, whatever our way of thinking is, we should understand it is not our nature eternally. It is our acquired nature. It is the nature, the characteristics that we have created ourselves according to what and who we choose to associate with in our lives, in this life and in previous lives. When we take birth, according to Bhagavad Gita, according to the characteristics we have acquired, we have a particular state of consciousness in this life. Some people are very dynamic. Yes, you have seen. And some people, they're just really lazy and lethargic. It's not that I'm just born that way. What can I do? It is through choosing lethargy in this life and maybe in previous lives that that becomes your nature, to be lazy. Some people by nature, they just can't stop complaining about everything and everyone. Have you ever met anyone like that? They just love to complain. In fact, they may not love it, they can't stop it. It's through complaining and complaining and associating with complainers that you develop that aptitude, that attitude. And similarly, when we associate with people who are positive, and when we choose to engage in a positive perspective with positive activities, then we recondition ourselves in that way. But this is the special virtue of human life, is we always have a freedom of choice. You may not be able to control the environment, but you do have full control of how you are going to respond and react to the environment. If you're on a boat, you may not have control over which way the wind blows, but you do have control over how you want to control the sails of your boat, how we're going to respond. You have a choice when very unpleasant things or unfair things come upon you. You can either choose to be a victim, or you could choose to learn a lesson. You can choose to complain and bring everybody else down. Misery likes company. Or you could choose to see what is the positive opportunity in this apparently miserable condition. Human intelligence is properly utilized when, in whatever situations come upon us, instead of simply reacting, we make an intelligent choice of what is actually the highest virtue that I can achieve. Seek and ye shall find, it is said in the Bible. Knock and the door will open. Every situation is an opportunity. It is said when opportunity knocks, most people complain about the noise. Vision is to see the invisible, to see the positive possibilities in every situation that comes upon us. This whole world, as far as perception, is a mirror of our own consciousness. Nobody sees the same thing in this world in the same way. Whatever and whoever we come in contact with, we are going to see according to our own state of consciousness. Yes, the world is just a mirror of our own attitudes. One person sees that, look at this rose bush. It's full of thorns. Grumbling about the thorns on the rose bush. And another person rejoices. Look at, the thorn bush has a rose. Arrivo! So they're seeing the same thing. But are they seeing the same thing? No. If you have rose-colored glasses, everything will look rose-colored. If you have yellow-colored glasses, everything will look yellow. If you have green-colored glasses, everything looks green. If you have clear-colored glasses, you see everything as it is. So yes, according to our state of consciousness, we have certain attitudes. And we will perceive reality according to our acquired attitudes. And how we choose, what attitude we choose to adopt in situations, is what is going to determine our future consciousness and our whole perception of the world. Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, he explained the mind in this way. He said, the mind is such a thing that it could make hell into heaven or heaven into hell. So what is it? Just like today. For some of you, this is like heaven, being in Krishna's temple. So nice and hot. And what is the heat? The heat is so many sincere and wonderful devotees, because we're crowded together. It's creating wonderful, auspicious, purifying heat. Yes? You can see it that way and rejoice. And we're hearing nice subject matter, and there is Thakurji, Sri Radha Gopinath presiding over, and so many esteemed guests. And somebody else may be thinking, it's hot, and I'm tired. And God, I came here to eat the ice cream. Why is he speaking so long? So it's just a matter of attitude. The ice cream's there. Please be patient. So we could make a hell out of heaven or a heaven out of hell with our own mind. I was telling the story some time back about when I was in a train in India, and it was so crowded. It was a third-class train. This was in 1970. And the capacity said something like 60 people, and there was probably 300 people in that train. And it was during the monsoon rain season. It was so hot. And in the middle of a rice paddy, there was a flood. We just sat there for about 8 hours, and we couldn't get out. There was no wind. They turned off the fans. It was very difficult. And I was so tired. I was being crushed. And somehow I found a place under a seat on a filthy, dirty floor. And people were eating peanuts above me and blowing the shells and the skins on my face. And I was getting kicked in the head by all people in the front and the back of me. But I had that little space. It was a space where I could actually lay down after about 40 hours. I could finally lay down. And I was so happy. I was so grateful. I tell you honestly that there is no person in the penthouse of the Taj Mahal Hotel who is more happy with their accommodations than I was. Why? Because it's a matter of perception. They're taking it for granted. They pay their money, they go to sleep, and they're probably complaining, oh, well, the air conditioner's not the right temperature, like that. But because of the desperate situation, it was heaven. Hell became heaven. It's just a matter of positive attitude. William Blake explained, famous saying. He made many, many famous sayings. One of them was, we read the Bible day and night. Thou, or you, read black, and I read white. Reading the same words, but according to our attitude, we have a whole different idea. Look at the world today. There's people who read the Holy Bible, the Holy Quran, the Holy Vedas, Bhagavad Gita. And when they read it, what do they get out of it? Of all these scriptures, we find there are people who learn, who from the reading of the same text, some people learn to hate, and others learn to love. They're reading the same words, And some people learn from it how to despise and take revenge. And others learn from the same words of the same book how to be compassionate and to forgive. Some read and find, I am great. I am the one. We are the chosen. We are better than all others. All others are inferior or should be exterminated. And others read the same words and they become humble and respectful to all. Same Bible, same Quran, same Vedas. People read the Vedas and become, I'm Brahman, you are untouchable. Ah. If I even see your face, I will bathe. And if you touch me, then I will have to do puja to neutralize the effects. Just keep at a distance and serve. And someone else, Vidyavanaya Sampani Brahmani Gavari Hastini Suni Chaiva Svapakicha Pandita Samadarshana, sees the spirit soul in every living being, a part of God in every living being, and sees the Brahman, the dog eater, the elephant, the cow, every living being is part of God and offers all respect, love, and compassion as an instrument of God. That's what the Gita teaches. To some people become humble and respectful to all, and some people become bigoted and sectarian and fanatical, reading the same scriptures. Why? It is all a basis of our association and our perception, our particular attitude. Vision means seeing the invisible. Seeing the potential in every situation in which I could do something very meaningful and good. Our spiritual master taught that even if you see a pile of ashes, now what is the value of ashes? People don't usually buy ashes. If there's one little spark, tiny little spark of fire, a person who has real virtue will concentrate on that little atomic particle of a spark, even if it's in an entire bed of worthless ashes, and will concentrate attention on fanning that spark and making it blaze into fire. In other words, seeing the potential rather than seeing the difficulty or the uselessness. When our Gurudev came to the Western world, he came to teach. No illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling, no meat eating, and complete devotion and surrender to a personal God. And he was speaking to people who were in a generation of free sex. In America in the 1960s, the most uncool or unpopular thing you can do is get married, because that's what everybody else does. But not the young generation. Yes. Free sex, free drugs, intoxication, gambling their life away, total meat-eating society, no conception of God amongst so many of these people in the counterculture. And these were the people that were coming to Swamiji. He could have easily... Untouchables, malechas, yavanas, I don't want to see your face. Get out, get out, get out. I'm going back to India. He could have been justified saying like that. But he saw.
He looked. What you seek, you will find. He looked for that spark. And there's a spark in everyone. A spark of potential goodness, even in the most evil person. And he just concentrated his full energy on that little spark and encouraged it and fanned it and made it into a blazing fire that burned away all of the other vices. That's positive attitude. Compassion means having a very positive attitude. If a doctor doesn't have a positive attitude about curing a patient, will he even try? Not with his heart. Maybe for some money he may cheat them and say, I'll cure you, when he knows he won't. But an honest doctor sees the potential to cure this person. So compassion means to see the potential good in someone, even if they're in a difficult, miserable situation, and actually outreach to help them. That is a very, very positive attitude. Even in this world, if it wasn't for people with extremely positive attitudes, what we take for granted today wouldn't exist. We're just speaking on a very relativistic platform. I just came here on an airplane. And in fact, we had to circle around Bombay a few times because the airport was overloaded with planes. There were so many planes on the runway. How many airplanes do you think take off and land in the world every day? Hare Krishna. Maybe next Purna festival I'll research and find out. But it's tens and thousands, yes? We see planes flying by all the time. We fly to Delhi, to Calcutta, to London. How do you think that happened? The first college I ever spoke at to give a lecture on the philosophy of Gita was in Dayton, Ohio. The name of the college was Wright State University. Because Dayton, Ohio is the place where the Wright brothers were from. I think Orville and Wilbur Wright. They were two brothers. They were farmers. They had this idea that man should fly. So now we take it for granted. But in those days, it was an impossible thing. They were trying to invent a machine that would make man fly. And people thought they were crazy. People thought they were lunatics. People thought totally unrealistic. Why are you wasting your time? The birds are supposed to fly. And the bats are supposed to fly. But men are not supposed to fly. Men cannot fly. You're not a bird. So they used to criticize them. And they spent hours and hours and days and months and years working on these machines to fly. And absolutely no one respected them, recognized them, or thought it was possible. They criticized them. You're fools. You're wasting your time. You're crazy. They were the laughing stock of the area. People would just laugh at them. Because they kept failing. They'd call people to watch sometimes, and they'd have this little machine that really looked strange. And they'd just be running with little bicycle wheels on it, and there were like these wings on it. And everyone would just laugh. Soon they stopped. They didn't even want to call anyone anymore. People just laughed at them, ridiculed them, but they persisted year after year after year after year. And ultimately, they flew in the sky. Only about
only a few yards.
But they actually went up in the air and they saw potential. And now look, the power of their positive attitude. It made the impossible possible. It became possible. Why? Because of the power of the positive attitude of people who believed in the ideal of what they were doing and didn't care what anyone or everyone said. They had faith in their ideal. What is it said about faith? With faith, you can see the invisible. You could believe the incredible, and you could receive the impossible. We have so many light bulbs. Yes, we're sitting in the light. We take it for granted. Thomas Edison had such a positive attitude. There's different explanations, but what I have read is almost 9,000 times he failed in experiments in making the light bulb. Now, would you persist after 20 times, 50 times, 1,000 times? 9,000 times he tried and failed. And you know something? He was, in every one of those times he failed and it didn't work, he was never disappointed, he was never depressed, he was enlivened. It's just a matter of your attitude. Thomas Edison's attitude was not that I failed. Thomas Edison's attitude was, this is fantastic. I have learned one other way it doesn't work. This is stepping stone to success. Huh? You can see the half empty glass, you can see the half full glass. It's a matter of your attitude. And it's this type of positive thinking that gives people the inspiration to carry on, even against all odds, and succeed. We're driving all these cars. Bombay's a mess. Maybe it would have been better if they didn't invent cars. But somehow or other we use them. We take them for granted. But back in the late 19th century and early 20th century in America, when Henry Ford and these other people were trying to make, everyone was driving in horses. Or some people even had bicycles. Bicycles were invented by Leonardo da Vinci in Italy way, way long back, about 500 years ago. So people were riding bicycles and they were riding horses. And when they just had these more, they didn't go anywhere. So many experiments, they weren't doing anything. And you know what people used to say when they see these people try, Henry Ford, they'd say, get a horse. Why are you wasting your time with this nonsense? Just get a horse. Be reasonable. Be practical. Do what's possible. But they had positive attitude. Practically everything we live with today, as far as modern technology, was born of people who had a particular vision, a particular perseverance, and an attitude that they didn't give up. Now, modern psychologists, they approach the attitudes of human beings based on the idea that a human being is a biological and mental being. And therefore, they psychologically try to help people to have a positive attitude accordingly, to help people with their physical and emotional conditions. This may be helpful, but it is incomplete. If they are not understanding the spiritual dimension of life,
Srimad Bhagavad Gita especially teaches about the spiritual dimension of life and its relationship with the mental, intellectual, egoistic, and gross forms of matter. It is the greatest and deepest science of reality. Krishna tells in Gita, Bhumir apaunalo vayu kamanara buddhir evacha ahankara iti ami bhina prakritirashtita. That there are eight basic material elements. There is earth, water, fire, air, and ether. There are basically 24 material elements. The five basic gross elements. And then there is the knowledge acquiring senses, the working senses, the objects of the senses. And then there is the Mahatattva in which everything is contained. And there is three subtle material elements. The mind, the intelligence, and the ego. But then Krishna explains in the next verse, Apare yamitashtvanyam prakritim virime param jiva bhuta mahabaho yagetam taryate jagat. That besides these inferior elements, there is a superior nature, which is the spirit soul, the conscious life force within all living beings. We are the soul, the Atma. We are the consciousness. And what is the nature of the consciousness? What is the nature of myself? Najayate mriyate vakadachit nayambutva bhavita vanabuya. Ajonyatya shashvato yampurano nahanyate hanyamane sarire. Krishna tells in Gita, for the soul there is no birth and there is no death. The soul is eternal, everlasting, primeval. It cannot be moistened by water. It cannot be burnt by fire. It cannot be withered by the wind. The soul is indestructible. The soul is Satchidananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. That is us. What is the relationship of the true self with the mind, the intelligence, and the ego? This is fundamental, basic understanding of truth. And what is the relationship between the soul, the mind, and the body? And material nature that surrounds us? Bhagavad Gita teaches us how to have a positive, blissful attitude in every situation that could come upon us, even death. To understand how the modes of material nature is working and what is our relationship is knowledge. And Bhagavad Gita was staged on a battlefield for very, very symbolic reasons. Here was Arjuna. He was on a battlefield and he was, against his own will, confronted with an insurmountable perplexity in his life. He was a good man. Why do bad things happen to good people? That's a common question. There's a reason. There's a reason for everything. But a really good person doesn't see anything as bad. He sees a good opportunity even in the bad. Let's just take a world view. If we objectively look at the world today, study the newspapers, the magazines, the statistics, there is a lot to really be depressed about. The types of pollution, the way people treat each other. So much rudeness, so much selfishness, so much egotism. Even families are breaking up and being enemies. There is a lot of evil in this world. There's a lot of darkness and cruelty in this world. There's terrorism. There's crime. There's so many terrible diseases. There's so much poverty. There's strife. There's earthquakes. There's about to be a volcano in Washington, D.C., yes? So many strifes in this world. There's droughts. There's floods. There's massive forest fires. Recently, I was in a very, very wealthy part of California, Malibu Beach, Laguna Beach, and they showed me where, just on the verge of the most wealthy houses, there was a massive forest fire. And there was really very little they could do. It just depends on the winds and the rain, whether your house is going to burn down or not. There's a lot to be depressed about if you really look at the world as it is. Would you agree? There was a newspaper article in America, I saw it. It talked about how one-third of the deaths of girls under 25 in South India is suicide. That's pretty serious. That's depressing. That's in your own country, in an area that's supposed to be very highly educated and cultured. One-third of girls who die under 25 is suicide? Suicide is the ultimate expression of frustration and hopelessness. It's a growing disease all over the world. So, if we objectively look at the world, we will naturally be very depressed. If we have a heart. Or we can be like ostrich. Everyone knows how the ostrich deals with crises. When the lion comes to eat the ostrich runs. And when he sees the lion's coming up behind him, he digs a hole in the ground and sticks his head in the ground and thinks, now I'm safe. Or the rabbit, when the fox is coming to eat the rabbit just, his ultimate weapon, he closes his eyes. And he just forgets that the fox is there. But the fact is, the tiger is about to eat the ostrich and the fox is about to eat the rabbit. Closing your eyes or sticking your head in a hole in the ground does not change the situation. So people in the world today, either they just don't want to hear about the problems of the world objectively, or they just, you know, stick their hole in the ground in the form of television or some sports event or whatever, just to forget it all. Yes, that's... Television's very, very popular. Sporting events are very popular. Do you really think people care so much about who hits the ball? Or what's happening on this tube that's just flashing lights? People take these things so seriously because they just want to forget the perplexities, the complexities, and the frustrations of life. It's a way of sticking your head in the ground or closing your eyes. Arjuna, when he was faced with this severe perplexity, he couldn't close his eyes or stick his head in the ground. He had to face the reality as it was, and he became severely depressed. If a clinical psychologist were to read Bhagavad Gita and see the symptoms of Arjuna, he would say, this man really needs some medication. Yes? He was shaking. Shake, his bow fell from his hand. He turned white. His dark complexion turned white. His mouth was dried up. Tears were brimming from his eyes. He was in a hopeless state. He was depressed. And then he decided he wanted nirvana. What does that mean? He decided, Krishna, I'm not going to stay on this battlefield. I'm not going to face this crisis. I'm going to the mountains. Better I just renounce everything and negate the problems altogether. Then I will be nirvana, peace. But negation of the negative is not the best solution. What did Krishna teach Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita? He taught him bhakti. What is bhakti? Bhakti is the culmination of jnana and vairagya. He told Arjuna that don't be depressed. Don't just artificially close your eyes and escape the problems of life. Don't run away and negate them. See the positive opportunity that you have in this situation and work accordingly. That is the teaching of the Gita. Do your work for the welfare of others, in a spirit of compassion to others, with consciousness of your relationship with God. That is what Gita is all about. Developing a very positive attitude. Not on the basis of just physical and emotional, but physical, emotional, and spiritual. The depth of our positive attitude is very much determined by how much we're in knowledge of our spiritual self. You could be very positive about various opportunities to make money and very positive to never give up, even despite so many failures, to invent something. You can work hard, so hard all your life, even against all odds, failure after success. One famous person said, success means one who goes through failure after failure after failure and does not lose enthusiasm. Another person said, the only time you fail is the last time you try. So in that sense, somebody who just works really hard and doesn't give up and has hope in what he could do or what she can do, that's positive thinking. But what happens when old age starts taking away your facilities and beyond your control, people you love start turning against you? It could happen. There's a famous lady in America who was so famous, everyone knew her name. Everyone bought her products. She was on the top of the world in fame and fortune. Now she's in prison. Now, I'm not one to judge whether she was right or wrong, but one thing we can see objectively is she didn't want to go to prison. But somehow or other, no matter how good you do, no matter how great you succeed, things could turn against you. I remember when I was a little boy, I saw an article in the newspaper about one of the sons of the Rockefeller who died. A horrible, ghastly death. Eaten alive by cannibals. It's the Rockefellers. You don't expect they're living in New York City. But he took a trip for some sociological PhD research on the cannibals of New Guinea. And somehow or other, he became the object of food for the object of his study. And I remember reading in the paper, here's one of the most powerful, wealthy men in the entire planet saying, I'll never find another happy day again in my life because my son is dead.
So inevitable circumstances can come upon us that are completely not according to our plan in life. And ultimately, everyone, whoever we are, has to come closer to death. A positive attitude based on emotional and biological considerations will not really help you to succeed through that crisis. It is only knowledge of the eternality of the soul. Bhagavad Gita teaches detachment in this sense, that whatever may happen, we should simply be grateful for the opportunity to serve in that situation and find happiness, knowing that ultimately, asochanan vasochas tvam, that every living entity is eternal. There really is no such thing as death. For a materialistic person, when their loved one dies, it's the end of that person's existence. That's very hard on the heart, is it not? This person ceases to exist. My own child, my lover, my parent. But Bhagavad Gita teaches the positive attitude, which is not based on sentiment, it's based on truth. That there's no death for anyone. We could do something. If a loved one dies, we could do something for them. We could pray for them. We could perform pujas and do service to God in a spirit of compassion to them, and their souls will get the benefit. The tradition of India is there is Shraddha and Pinda for the departed ancestors. But in essence, when we perform devotional service to the Lord, in Srimad Bhagavatam it is said that one who surrenders to Krishna, 21 generations of all relatives, past and future, get liberated. There's something positive that we can do to show our love even for the departed souls. Otherwise, you know, we just burn a candle and cry because they're dead and gone. So yes, Bhagavad Gita teaches how there's a positive opportunity in every situation. And however bad the world may be as far as all kinds of corruption and pollution and evil, we can always look for the good. We know about the bad. We don't just hide from it. We know about it. We're conscious of it. But we look for the good. We fan the sparks. And we try to act as instruments of God's compassion in this world according to our capacity. And that brings us tremendous positive fulfillment in life. Some people say that when you take to the teachings of Gita or you become a devotee of Krishna, you're escaping the world. But that's the most ridiculous misconception. We don't want to escape. We want to face it for what it is. But we want to see it in such a way that we see the goodness. We deal with the badness, we see the goodness, we see the bad, but we see the opportunity of how we could try to do something wonderful according to our capacity. And that brings us bliss. To know we're trying to actually help brings us inner and true satisfaction. And that takes a positive attitude based on knowledge. As long as we are attached to being the enjoyer of this material energy, as long as we have selfishness
and greed and envy and lust and pride within our heart, there's going to be so many frustrations because we're trying to exploit the actual liberated state. Is the service attitude. We don't want to possess. We don't want to exploit. We don't want to control. We want to serve. Now, if we can serve by controlling, our motive is to serve. That attitude is free from selfishness. It's liberating. It's the actual supreme most positive attitude to serve in all situations with complete faith in God. Faith in the goodness of God and the potential in every possible situation. And how does that state of consciousness come? Through association. If you associate with negative people, you will become very, very negative. In fact, I was speaking to a very, very high level managing consultant. And he said that even in a company, one person who's seriously negative can spoil the whole operation. Just like one bad apple could make all the apples turn bad. It's depressing to be with somebody who is negative and complaining, is it not? But even in difficult situations, when we see somebody is hopeful and enthusiastic, it brings life, it brings enthusiasm, it brings hope and happiness. To associate with those people and to associate with those free choices that bring us closer to God, that increase our faith in God, and simultaneously raise our values in life, that will transform our hearts. I'll give a couple examples. Our own beloved Guru Maharaj Srila Prabhupada. He had such incredible positive thinking based on faith. Many of you know the story. He left India when he was 69 years old, crossing the Arabian Sea on a cargo ship named MV Jaladuta. He had two heart attacks. He was 70 years old on the ship. Two heart attacks. Seasickness. And still, he had to cross Africa, the Suez Canal, and the entire Atlantic Ocean. And when he arrived, for some short stay, he was in Butler, Pennsylvania, at some stranger's house. And then he was living in the Bowery, a ghetto of New York. Living in the esteem of the highest saint. And around him were drunkards, prostitutes, drug addicts, and criminals. The lowest ghetto in America in those days was Bowery. He had no other place. Someone just let him stay on his floor. He had such a positive attitude. If you read his diary, somebody gave him a tape recorder and he taped himself chanting Hare Krishna. And he taped not only kirtan but some little speech along with it. And he had a program at somebody's apartment and only about 3-4 people came and he played the tape. And Prabhupada writes in his diary, he said that they came. They couldn't understand the words. They couldn't understand what I was saying, but they seemed interested. 3-4 people, they seemed interested. He says, now I know that Haridas Thakur's prophecy that the
holy name will convert and transform the hearts of people all over the world will come true.
Now, how many of us, if Gaurgopal Prabhu or Gauranga Prabhu traveled all across the world and was in some little ghetto apartment and 3-4 people came and they couldn't even understand what they were saying, would they see this as a sign that the mission of Krishna is going to spread all over the world and be ecstatic about it?
What? Most people would be very depressed. But Prabhupada was positive outlook. Any little thing he saw is Krishna's sign to encourage him to go on. Any little thing. He would report to his godbrothers what were going on, and they were saying, back in India, they were saying, forget it, just come back. It's useless. Nobody else could see it. He had the positive outlook. And then some boy named Paul invites him to stay in his apartment. And Prabhupada, it was on the 5th floor, dark stairway to get up there. It was just a loft. Do you know what a loft is? It's just a small place that are used for warehouses back in the 19th century when Manhattan was developed. And they're just basically practically condemned buildings, and poor people just make those little warehouses into their home. It's one room, no partition. It's just one room, and that one room is the kitchen, the bathroom, the bedroom, the living room, the dining room, the exercise room, everything. There's one little dull light bulb hanging from the ceiling with some cobwebs. And Prabhupada's writing back, we have a temple now in New York City. He's writing to his godbrother, come, now we have a temple. Now our mission to teach the pure lesson of Bhagavad Gita. We actually have a center now in Bhagavad Gita in New York City, Manhattan, come. Now, for most of us to be in that place, we wouldn't even think, this is a temple? This is a center? And a few days later, that boy Paul got intoxicated with some kind of LSD and threatened to kill Prabhupada and kicked him out of his house. He accused Prabhupada of using his soap and actually went to kill him. So Prabhupada was homeless. The streets of New York, why didn't he return? He still saw, with a positive attitude, that things were unfolding. A little later, he writes in his diary, today, according to the Vedic calendar, it is Gaur Purnima, the Adivas, the appearance day of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He said, all my God brothers, they are in Vrindavan and Navadweep celebrating with kirtan and with katha and in the association of so many wonderful loving people. He said, I am all alone in New York City. There is not another Vaishnav within 10,000 miles. He said, but I am happy because I am doing the work of my spiritual master. I have no personal self-interest. Whatever I'm doing is in their service, the mission of their compassion. So a situation where most anybody would be lonely and depressed and what am I doing in this place? On that day, it was snowing and he has no warm clothes. He's in New York. Very difficult. But he's ecstatic. He's happy. He's seeing positive opportunity. I'm selflessly doing this as a servant. I don't care whatever inconvenience. I don't care whatever sex or failure may be coming. I'm doing this as a service. And because I know I'm pleasing Krishna, that's all that matters. I know I'm trying to do good for humanity. That's all that matters. And then sometime later, he was just staying at someone's house
not a house, another Bowery flat. And they got him a little storefront in the Lower East Side, small little storefront. Some well-wishers paid the first month's rent and said, "Swamiji, we won't be able to help you after this." And he had no income. He had no support. He had nothing. And he calls some well-wishers together to... What did he do? He registered a religious organization within America, with the government. And he called it the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And the few little well-wishers who were becoming, just barely becoming devotees, just a few people who had no money at all, "Swamiji, international? We don't even know if we have money for the next month rent for this little tiny storefront in the Lower East Side. What is this international?" He said, no. "We have temples all over the world. We have millions of books being distributed. We have farm communities. It's only separated by time." That's a positive attitude. And he did it. Because with that positive attitude, which was based on his complete faith in the teachings of Bhagavad Gita, complete faith in Krishna. Krishna told Arjuna, "When you fight this battle, Arjuna, whether you win or lose is not important. What's important is you're doing it for the right purpose. You're doing it to please me. That is your success." Prabhupada wrote in his prayers to Krishna on that cargo ship that, "Krishna, everything's up to you. I'm only your puppet. I'm coming to do your will and the will of my spiritual master, my Guru Maharaj. Whatever success or failure is in your hands." He had that faith. He had positive outlook. Years later, he came back to India, and what kind of a difficulty he had in this building of the temple in Juhu Beach. There was nothing but aggression, persecution, and opposition against him on every level. And he was just one small Swamiji with a few devotees who were totally inexperienced in any of these things, up against political parties, wealthy industrialists. What chance did he have? Materially, he had no chance. But he had one thing. He had a positive outlook, born of his faith and his service attitude. He took the deities of Radha Ras Bihari and put them in a little, built a little tin shack for them, straw hut, and told the deities, "This is for you. I'm doing this for you. Please allow me to build this temple for you. It's against all odds and it's impossible." Prabhupada had a regular saying that he used to teach us on a regular basis. "Impossible is a word in a fool's dictionary. Nothing is impossible with the grace of God. There are many things impossible for you and me, but with the grace of God, nothing is impossible." And now we see Radha Ras Bihari Temple, so many tens and thousands, hundreds and thousands of people, millions of people go there. Beautiful temple. Even Prabhupada's own disciples completely gave up all faith in the possibility of building that temple. In the middle of this difficult conflict, they gave up and said, "Prabhupada, it's impossible. We're wasting our time." And Prabhupada said, "Impossible is a word in a fool's dictionary." And he persevered. And I want to tell you something else. Association is contagious. Prabhupada had such positive attitude due to his faith in Krishna and his desire to show compassion to others. We have here an example of a person who was an instrument of Prabhupada's enthusiastic positive attitude. His name is Shyam Sundar Prabhu. Can you please stand up, Shyam Sundar Prabhu? He won't stand up. And because he's my elder godbrother, I can only bow at his feet. Please listen to this story. You are all about the age or older than he was at this time. What were you, about 22 or something? What was your age when you met Prabhupada in San Francisco? 25. He was a 25-year-old boy. We're not going to go into his background before he met Prabhupada. But he didn't know much about Gita or Bhagavat or any of these things. But he met Prabhupada in the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco. And he saw Prabhupada's enthusiasm. He saw that Prabhupada saw that everything is possible if we're working in a spirit of compassion and love for God and humanity. He saw with his own eyes how Prabhupada came to New York and began with nothing, how he came to San Francisco with nothing, and how he just had so much enthusiasm and so much hope and so much faith. It was contagious. At that time, the most famous, influential, and difficult people to meet in the entire Western world was a musical band called the Beatles. Have you all heard of the Beatles here in India? I think they broke up in 1970. That was 34 years ago, and even in India you know about them. Whatever they said was, it was like the word of God to the young generation of America. They were the authorities. Whatever they wore, people would wear. Whatever they thought, they would think. And there were millions of people who wanted to see them, to touch them, to meet them. And they were really, really isolated and in seclusion. Yes? By that time, they stopped all public concerts because they just didn't want to be near people. It was too much. Just crowds and fanaticism. So here's Shyam Sundar. He's a 25-year-old boy living in San Francisco, and he writes to Prabhupada, right? Prabhupada wrote to Mukunda Maharaj and writes to Mukunda Maharaj that Shyam Sundar wants to go to London to make the Beatles devotees of Krishna. I think it's a good idea. Yes? Something like that? So Prabhupada said, I think it's a good idea. And Shyam Sundar Prabhu goes to London with his wife and a newborn little baby that's hardly 1 year old. What was her age? Huh? He went to London when she was 3 months old. They didn't have a home. They didn't know anyone. At times, the wife and baby and husband were living in a cardboard box in a basement of a warehouse. Yes? And their mission was to make the Beatles devotees. Haribo! Now, what would the odds be if we were gamblers and they just went to London and landed? What would the odds be that they would be making the Beatles devotees? Perhaps 5 billion to 1? What do you think? Within about a half a year, they were living in John Lennon's house, who is the leader of the Beatles. They were living in his house, and they invited Prabhupada to come and live with them. And George Harrison, the lead guitar player, became a devotee. And they made records for them. Their records, the Radha Krishna Temple, was the number one record album in most of Europe. And the single record, the Hare Krishna mantra, was the number one record in many parts of Europe also, including London. Yes? Top 10. And George Harrison remained a devotee the rest of his life. That is just one out of so many examples in Shamsundar Prabhu's life. Where did he get that enthusiasm? Where did he get that positive attitude to do what was impossible? Because of his association with a person who had deep faith in the eternality of the soul and in a selfless service attitude to God, to Krishna. Association is contagious. Earlier this year, one of our very, very dear godbrothers who visited this temple, Sridhar Swami, His Holiness Sridhar Swami Maharaj, he departed from this world. He had a very, very difficult disease. And physically he suffered for many years. But you know what his name was amongst those who knew him? The Jolly Swami. He was always laughing. He was always making everyone happy. Positive attitude. He told me on many occasions, he said, pain may be inevitable, but suffering is optional. Regularly told me this. Because it's our free choice whether we want to suffer or not. The experience of pain is there. That may not be a choice. But how we're going to, what our attitude is of how we're going to perceive it is optional. We could see it as the grace of God, and actually, even though physically we're hurting, we can find deep fulfillment and gratitude and so many lessons to learn, and we can feel ourselves the bliss of being purified, or we can simply suffer. Everything is a matter of choice, what our mood is, how we're going to interpret a particular situation. He was grateful. I'll end the class with another story which really deeply moved my heart. One of my god sisters, her name was Kunti Devi, and through the course of this story you'll find how Prabhupada gave her a very suitable name. She was a devotee, a mother of two children. Her husband left her. She remained faithful. She was never a big leader. She was never a person that people, you know, honored and respected as being a person of high position. She was a simple mother and a very, very dedicated devotee of Krishna. Those who knew her well honored her, but there were not so many people who knew her well. And then she got cancer of the breast. And that cancer spread, viciously spread, and entered into her spine and her organs and was just crippling her. The doctors, it was such a ferocious case of cancer, they said there's absolutely nothing that anyone can do. You have 6 months to live maximum. At that time she was working, trying to support her children in Idaho. But she loved to read Prabhupada's books. She loved to chant Hare Krishna. She had complete faith in Krishna. She's an American lady. At that time, she was in her 40s, I believe. She was practically paralyzed from the waist down. She was on a wheelchair. and according to the medical analysis, she was racked with pain. And she was always smiling and always encouraging and making everyone happy. It was so phenomenal how blissful she was, how positive she was, that the local television station heard about it. They met her, and they never had seen anything like this in their life. The deterioration of her body, the doctor's diagnosis, her physical symptoms, everything was utterly hopeless and miserable except one thing: her consciousness. She was just telling everybody how beautiful life one is and how wonderful Krishna is and how fortunate she is, and see the good fortune in everything that happens. I saw the television show. Incredible. The master of ceremonies, or what do they call those people on their shows? It was a news show. Huh? The host. It was a hostess. Was just praising her. It was a half-hour program about her, I believe. And it just showed her, you know, in kirtan, there were devotees chanting, and she was just smiling and chanting and praying, and she was talking to people and giving lectures to people about the beauty of life and the beauty of bhakti and the good fortune of anyone who has Krishna. And they were interviewing her, and the hostess asked, "How could you be so happy when you're in such a condition?" And she said, "Because I know I'm the soul. I'm eternal. This body is just a temporary situation. And this situation is bringing my soul closer to God. Therefore, I'm rejoicing. I'm happy." Now, you can't just say that theoretically in that situation. She was living what she was speaking. And even just ordinary materialistic people could see that. And they were on the television station praising her and glorifying her as a Hare Krishna devotee because of her personal qualities. Later she came to our community, and she was in such a state that, I'll just tell a few stories, it's very worth hearing. Even though she was in such a condition, and everyone around her is young and strong and full of life, and she's giving encouragement and hope to everyone. She couldn't eat the regular diet of the community. So with her wheelchair, she went in to cook for herself, and she invited anybody else who wanted to come. And she cooked so wonderful, soon she was cooking for about 20 or 30 people a day. They didn't want any other food except hers. For weeks and weeks, months, she was cooking for everybody, and she was happy serving them on a wheelchair. She can hardly move. The disease progressed. She couldn't even get on. She had to just lay down. She didn't even have the strength to pick up a book. Some people let her use a computer, because all Prabhupada's books, our Guru Maharaj's books, are on what is called folio on a computer, where instead of lifting a book, she could just press fingers on buttons and any page of the books she could access. And she's laying there like this. And I went into her room, and she was smiling. She was glowing with bliss. And she said, "Kunti Devi told me that some people are feeling sorry for me. They think I'm in an unfortunate condition." She said, "I am so fortunate. I'm not on my deathbed. For me, this is not just a deathbed. I'm on the bank of the Ganges, just like Maharaj Parikshit, listening to Sukadev Goswami speak through my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada." She said, "In my desperate condition, I'm by reading this message of the scriptures, I'm hearing these words like I never heard them before. I feel that Gurudev and Krishna are directly and personally speaking to me with each word. I never experienced this before. She said, if this is what it takes to hear that, it's a small price. I would not trade the position I'm in today with anyone else in the entire world. This is a blessing. This is God's grace. She was grateful and she was crying in gratitude. At a certain point, her health went really bad and she practically fell unconscious and they brought her to a hospital. And when she came out of her unconscious state, some devotees went to try to... What do you do when a person's dying in a hospital? You try to encourage them, yes? But as soon as she came to consciousness, she was smiling and encouraging everyone else. One man in his 50s, he came to cheer her up, but he was having all kinds of problems. And ended up that she was telling him how to have a positive attitude toward his problems by having faith in Krishna and being detached from the results and having a service attitude. And he came out of the room. I came to help her, and she just solved all my problems. And that's on the verge of death. I happened to have the fortune of being at her bedside when she left this world. She was surrounded by loving devotees chanting the holy names. And she just lovingly just gave her heart and her life to Krishna in a totally positive, grateful, and happy state. Now, you can't get that consciousness even from the best psychologist or psychiatrist. They can do their work and they can do good to a certain extent. But a real, true, and deep positive attitude in life has to come by knowledge and realization of the eternal, blissful nature of the soul. And the all-attractive, all-merciful, beautiful nature of God. And our relationship. And the beautiful, wonderful opportunities to serve God at every moment. Sukadev Goswami says, better one moment of full consciousness than a whole long life of just very ordinary, relativistic, mundane consciousness. Human life is meant for quality. And what is important to achieve that quality of real good character is we must have a positive attitude. We must never give up. We must understand what is really valuable in life and cultivate the faith through proper activity and association in which we could live by that ideal and never betray that ideal. A great person is a person who lives with integrity. To be truthful with others is honesty. To be truthful with yourself is integrity. To be truthful with God, to be honest, without hypocrisy before God, is to be truthful to yourself. That is real integrity. Proper association, hearing positive, enlightening spiritual subject matter, cleanses the heart and awakens a positive outlook that comes from the very depths of the soul. And actually, that is the reason we chant God's names. It's not just a superstitious, ritualistic, religious activity. The chanting of God's names is a scientific process of cleaning the heart of hypocrisy, of darkness, of envy, greed, pride, lust, illusion, and envy. And actually accessing the beautiful spiritual qualities of our original nature. And to live with such a positive attitude through accessing our very essence through the chanting of the holy names. Thank you very much.
Positive attitude, we may lose many things. So is it a pessimistic approach? What do you say about this?
We should have discrimination, and we should use our intelligence in a very positive way. It really depends on the particular situation, but we can have a very positive attitude with intelligence and discrimination as well. Intelligence and discrimination is very important. And also to use one of the most uncommon things within the world today, called common sense. No, just like we were speaking of Prabhupada, he had his hopes and he had his plan, but he wouldn't let people cheat him. He was very, very much careful. But his ideal was going to be fulfilled. He was going to give his life. He was going to live and die for it with complete faith in Krishna. But at the same time, he didn't indiscriminately waste time or allow himself to be cheated. He was intelligent. So having faith and having positive attitude doesn't mean just foolishly rushing into situations. It means to use our intelligence, to use our God-given discretion, and to pursue it in a very positive, hopeful way with faith and integrity and detachment. What does Krishna say in Gita about detachment? Detachment doesn't mean detachment from trying your best. He told Arjuna, you must fight with all of your power, with all of your intelligence, with all of your discrimination, but don't be attached to enjoying the result yourself. Be attached to the service. If you win, you will get the world. If you lose, you will go to the spiritual world. If you have the right ambition, you can't fail. Failure means to give in to evil. If you become a multimillionaire or billionaire through evil ways, you have failed. From the point of view of the soul, you're going to have to suffer all the reactions of everything you've done to get to that place. That's not success. Whether you attain your ideal, or let us say whether you attain your goal or not, real success is you preserve your integrity and your character. And you do it by right means. then whether you win or lose by material vision, you've won. You've won the battle against Maya or illusion. So that's what's all important. If with faith, integrity, and proper character, we work as hard as we can to fulfill our duty. And the effort itself is our success. For Arjuna, whether he won or lost, he was successful. For Duryodhana, whether he won or lost, he was a failure. Yes? Because one had the right motives and one had the wrong motives. One had a service attitude, a spirit of compassion and devotion, and the other was motivated by greed and envy. The world has enough greedy, envious people. They're not making it a better place. We need people who are as using their intelligence and their abilities to their full capacity in a spirit of devotion and service. Yad yad acharati sthrestas tat tat evetarojanasya yat pramanam kurute lokas taranuvartate. We need leaders who are going to teach people by their example the path of Dharma. Not that we sell our souls for the cheap, glittering ornaments of this world. Huh? That is important. So yes, use your discrimination, use your intelligence, use your valor with the right motive, the right ideal, and with a pure heart. And that is your success. God sees the purpose in which we act. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Prabhu, you mentioned the importance of association in developing a positive attitude. Sometimes it is very hard to find a positive association. So what do we do in that situation? How do we develop a positive attitude? It's difficult.
Jesus said, seek and ye shall find. If you seek, you will find. And even if it's not so readily available, then you be that association. You can get it in positive books. You can get it in positive tapes. You could get it in corresponding with positive people. And whenever possible, to be in the physical association of positive people. If you want it, you'll find it. It's there. I know somebody who was living in a completely far away place and just have one book, the Bhagavad Gita, and just immersed himself so much in that Bhagavad Gita as it is that his whole life transformed. He gave up illicit sex, intoxication, gambling, meat eating. He was chanting Krishna's name throughout the day. He was working a very dangerous job. He was a welder. You know, welder? Where you burn steel and forge it into other pieces of steel. But he was working on very, very highly dangerous petrochemical plants where he was like fixing things way, way up, you know, many stories high, highly explosive facilities. You get paid a lot to do that, risking your life. As he was working in those situations, never met a devotee, didn't even know devotees existed. One day he was just, this is a true story, one day he was just at a laundromat, a place where you get your clothes washed, and he was eating a watermelon and he was spitting the seeds into the garbage bin, and accidentally the watermelon slipped out of his hand and went into the garbage bin. And he didn't want to lose that watermelon. So he reached into the watermelon, he reached into the garbage bin and picked up that piece of watermelon right out of the garbage and looked at it, and it was a Bhagavad Gita as it is. He reached down, he thought it was watermelon, but he dropped, but it was the Bhagavad Gita. So he thought, God must want me to read this. He started reading it. For a couple years, that was his only association, one book. But he became saintly, gentle, humble. He was intoxicated with Krishna. So positive attitude means to be grateful to what we have. To be grateful for whatever God gives us. That's enough if we're just sincere, in earnest. Yes? So association's there if we look for it and we want it. Yes.
We are coming to the temple and we are listening to the lectures and listening that surrender to the God. But we are getting the difficulties surrendering fully. So what is the solution for that? And how to be determined?
Before you could run cross country, you have to learn how to crawl. And then after learning how to crawl, you have to learn how to take your first step. Yes. Any destination begins with the first step. Man can move mountains by beginning with the first stone. Yes. We have to simply persevere from whatever position we're at with honesty and sincerity. And Krishna tells us in Gita, Ananyas chintayantomam yejana paryupashate tesham nityabhayuktanam yogakshemam vahamyaham. If we're just honest and sincere, God will help us. God will help us in every way. How he helps us, he may put many impediments on the path. But if we understand that with a positive attitude, that yes, this is a good thing that's happening. This obstacle, this tragedy, it's a good thing. There's something for me to learn. There's something for me to grow through this process. Then we will grow and we will learn. Association is important to maintain that proper attitude, even at the beginning stages where we're just learning to crawl spiritually. And if you just have that positive attitude, a nice association, and the perseverance, then soon you will be running to Krishna. Does that answer your question? Every journey begins with first step. But there has to be faith for us to continue on. And we're not speaking of blind faith. We're speaking faith based on philosophy, logic, and authority. That faith is real faith. And that faith can carry us through all obstacles and inspire us to carry on even when we're so very, very far away. If we just have that faith and that sincerity, the only thing that separates us from our ultimate aspiration is a little bit of time. Because where there's faith and there's sincerity and there's honesty, that attracts mercy. And through mercy, everything is possible. Yes.
Hare Krishna. What is better, looking at the object as it is, as an observer, or looking at the object with positive attitude? For example, had Siddhartha Gautam ever tried to look at the miseries of the world or life with positive attitude, do you think he
would
have...
Can you say that again? Has...
Sorry?
Say that again, please.
Okay. What is better, looking at the object as it is, as an observer, or looking at the object with positive attitude? For example, had Siddhartha Gautam ever tried to look at the miseries of the life, Gautam Buddha, had he ever turned, would he have ever turned into Buddha?
Actually, he had a very positive attitude. That's how he became Buddha. He saw the realistic problems of birth, old age, disease, and death. And he had faith that he could overcome those miseries and that he could teach the world how to overcome those miseries. That's a positive outlook. He saw the problem, but he had that faith that I could do it and I will do it. Yes? Otherwise, what kept him going? He could have just gone into depression or committed suicide. He saw old people, he saw sick people, he saw dead people. It broke his heart. It was intolerable for him. I must find the solution, and I will. And he did asceticism. For years and years he did asceticism with a positive attitude that I'm going to become free from this and teach the world. But he failed. He actually failed miserably. All his asceticism and all the people who were teaching him asceticism, he came to the conclusion after years and years of torturing his body through fasting and subjecting his entire body to gruesomely painful elements, he came to the conclusion that I'm not getting anywhere. The only result I'm getting of all this torture is more torture. So he left them all. And he persevered. He didn't give up. He went to that Bodhi tree, the people tree in Bodh Gaya today. How many of you have been there? I used to live there long ago. But he was under that people tree called the Bodhi tree. And he just vowed, I'm not going to get up until I attain that state of enlightenment where I can teach the world how to be free from miseries. That's positive outlook. He didn't give up. Impossible for him was a word in a fool's dictionary. And he did it. And he taught the world what he found. So having a positive outlook doesn't mean being unrealistic or not objective. In spiritual consciousness, it really means the opportunity to see the grace of God in that situation. The opportunity to see how I can serve, how I could learn, and how I can help others and better my own life in this situation. And that opportunity is always there in every possible situation in this world, if we look for it. Our consciousness can transform tragedy into something that may still be a tragedy on one level, but it can also transform that into something beautiful. Because to be an instrument of compassion in a tragic situation is a beautiful thing, is it not? When there's a tragedy and people come out of a genuine spirit of selfless compassion to help those people, isn't that something good? Yes, the situation may be apparently horrible, but we could do something good in that situation. We could do something positive in that situation. That opportunity is always there. Is there another question?
My question is, Guruji.
Where are you?
Yeah, this.
Haribol.
As far as I know and as far as I have read in religion.
We can hear you.
Hello.
Yes. As far as I have read in religious books, it is said that the ultimate aim of a person should be soul perception. And I would like to know how it is done. It is done through reading religious books, or it is also said if a person cannot be trouble-free, tension-free or fearless until and unless he doesn't do what you say, soul perception. Or it is also said in Hindi, it is known as Atma Sakshatkar. So how it is done that? And what is the actual meaning of this soul perception?
Krishna tells in Gita, Nashito vidyate bhavo nabhavo vidyate shita ubhayor apidristantas tvaniyastvata darshati. That the great seers of the truth, they understand that what is temporary is not true reality. What is eternal is true reality. Najayate mriyate vakadachit. The soul is eternal. Reality is to understand our original spiritual substance, which is consciousness, which is part of God. Now, to live in harmony with our nature is true, is Sanatan Dharma. There are many types of Dharma. Dharma means that which is inseparable from one's nature. The Dharma of sugar is to be sweet. The Dharma of a chili pepper is to be hot. What is the Dharma of every living being? Our Dharma is to serve. Everyone has to serve. We have to serve the government. We have to serve our family members. We have to serve our employers, or we have to serve our employees. We're always serving our senses. We're serving our mind. We can't live without serving. And what is Sanatan Dharma? That means the eternal, original service of every living being. And that is service to God. So real soul perception is not only the gyan of understanding that I am the eternal soul, but what is the nature of the soul? What is the quality of the soul? And what is the activity of the soul? Sarva dharman parityaja mame kam sharanam braja aham tvam sarva papebhyo mokshaye shami masucha. The eternal nature of the soul is to please God, to serve God. And what is the greatest? Krishna explains in Gita that the greatest service to God we can do in this world is to be an instrument of His compassion to enlighten others. Not in a fundamentalist sectarian way, but in a compassionate way. So we hear about God, we read the holy words of God, we chant the names of God, to purify our heart and bring our and access the grace of God within our own lives. For what purpose? So that our words and actions will be pure. And we can do wonderful things in everything. Yat karosi yadashnasi, yaj dohoshitatasiyat, yat tapasyasi kontiyat, tat kurushubadarparam. This is Bhagavad Gita. All that you do, all that you offer and give away, all that you eat, all charity you perform, it should all be done as an offering to me. What does that mean? It should be done in a spirit of being instrumental of God's love in this world. In service. To please Krishna. That is practical soul perception. And that is the means of attaining soul perception. This chanting of mantra, which delivers the mind from the egoistic, contaminated pursuits, actually gives us realization of our eternal nature. But we also must act according to that nature and speak according to that nature. Lord Chaitanya taught, Trinadapi sunichena taror ibasihishnuna amanina manadena kirtaniya sadahari. If only the world followed this principle, what a wonderful place we would live in. Lord Chaitanya said that to chant the name of the Lord in proper consciousness, we should be humble like the blade of grass, tolerant like a tree. We should be eager to offer all respects to everyone and expect no respect for oneself, no false prestige. If we practice these principles in a service attitude and chant God's names, yes, by the mercy of the Absolute, we will have realization of the eternal beauty of life at every moment. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. Why everything is not possible with love? Even if one is fully positive, the other one is not. But it never ends up with both. Please explain.
Very nice question. It depends on the particular time, place, circumstance that you're speaking of. But in a general principle, we have to use our intelligence and we have to work hard. If we're positive and lazy, yes, everything's all right, everything's good, everything's beautiful, I'm just going to sleep. There's no reason to work. Everything's nice. What is the use of that positiveness? You shouldn't be positive in a way to justify your laziness. And some people are very positive about sinful activities. Yes, yes, everything's all right, just take this heroin and you'll be happy. No problem, all the world's problems, it's all the grace of God. Just an actual positive attitude that we're speaking of today is positive attitude based on truth, based on real human spiritual values. Krishna explains there's two very, very serious enemies on the spiritual path. One is egoism and the other is laziness. We can't be lazy. We must be dynamic, we must be enthusiastic, and we must work hard for our purposes in performance, our duties, and balance our domestic, our occupational, and our spiritual duties in such a way that we're pleasing God through morality, through ethics, and through spiritual cultivation. That is important. So positive attitude must be with a proper disposition. And if we have that proper disposition and we're enthusiastic to do the right thing in the right way, then even if we fail, we don't fail. You know the story about the race between the rabbit and the turtle? Everyone knows that story. Who won the race? Turtle or rabbit? How many vote for the rabbit? How many vote for turtle? Arrivo. Now, that story gives me a lot of hope since I've been a little child, because I was never very good at anything. But the rabbit really knows how to run a race. And the turtles just... Now, what was the difference between the rabbit and the turtle? The rabbit was proud. The rabbit ran and then he had just enjoyed. And the turtle, just according to his very, very minimal capacity, just persevered. Just didn't stop. Just kept going and going and going. And the rabbit was sporadic. He'd run and then he'd sleep. And then he'd run and he'd sleep. And 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 the turtle was just... And he won. And he won. So at first you don't succeed. Try again. Huh? I'm sure there were other inventors who, during the 9,000 failures of Thomas Edison, there were other inventors inventing other things and succeeding. But he didn't give up on his pursuit. And ultimately, we never heard of all the others, but we heard of him. Because he didn't give up, and he actually attained his goal. So as long as you have the right consciousness, the right attitude, and the right integrity, and the right spiritual principles, then just keep trying. There's no question of failure. It may just be a matter of time till you succeed. Yes? Or it may be that your failure is what you need for your growing. And in that case, it's a success. If we learn from our failure, that lesson is a success in itself. And it may be more valuable than getting the glory and the credit and the income of this world. Failures are stepping stones to greater success. If we have positive attitude based on the principles of real values. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Sir, I have two questions for you. First one, what is Nishkam Karma? Second one, when you reach the state of realization of a God, when your frequency matches with God's frequency, that means you yourself becomes God. At that stage, you have no wants which you have in practical life, in material world. Say anything, attraction towards anything, those wishes, nothing is remained to be achieved at that stage. And you have something which you don't want, means you want nothing. Then at that stage, does that mean that your mind becomes totally pure? Because at that stage, your want is to want nothing. These two questions I have for you. Thank you.
Thank you. The answer to both can be spoken together. That to work without selfish desires, to work without fruitive attachment, is Nishkam Karma. But what does that mean? According to Bhagavad Gita, Ishopanishad, Srimad Bhagavatam, Ramayana, Mahabharata, that means to work in a spirit of surrender and to work in a spirit of love. It doesn't mean to become God. No one can become God. Either you're God or you're not God. God doesn't become God. And if we think that I'm God, but I forgot that I'm God, but when I remember, then I'll be God again. God does not forget. Krishna says in Gita, Sarvasya Chaham Hriti Shani Vishtoma Tasmiti Rajnanam Apohanam Cha. Krishna says that I am the source of remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. If God is supreme, how can God forget that He's God? That means forgetfulness is supreme. God never falls under the control of His own energies. He's supreme. Yes? So how could we be God? Krishna tells in Gita, Mamayvamso jivaloke jivabhuta sanatana. Manashashtanindriyani prakriti stani karashati. That we are part and parcel of God. Qualitatively, we are one with God. We are eternal, full of knowledge and bliss, Satchidananda. But the relation between the soul and God is like the sun ray and the sun. The sun ray is qualitatively one as the sun. It gives off heat and light. But the sun ray is a particle of the sun. In one sense, it is the sun, but in another sense, it is only a part. It is not the sun. If a sun ray comes into the room, we're happy. If the sun planet comes into the room, it would be a different experience. So to realize our godliness and to realize our relationship, our identity with God, is to love God. And to love God means to love every part of God. When you love the whole, you love every part. Universal love is when you love Krishna, you'll see every living being as part of Krishna. So there will be natural, spontaneous, intimate love for every living being. Even those who come to kill you. Hate the disease, but not the diseased. Hate the sin, but not the sinner. Because everyone's good. Everyone is essentially part of God. But according to people's misuse of their free will and making bad choices, people become so conditioned and so habituated, sometimes to very evil and horrible things. People can be rapists and terrorists and murderers. But essentially, they're part of God. They're good. They're just so totally covered over by Rajaguna and Tamaguna. But if you love God, you even love them. You feel compassion and sympathy even for them. So this is actual to work in a spirit of love for God and love for all living entities in a spirit of service is actually the highest perfection and the original nature of the consciousness. Can you turn the microphone?
Sorry to interrupt you, sir, but yes? You just said about rajogun, tamogun, three types of gun, sattvagun, rajogun, tamogun. But when you reach the state as the Gautam Buddha reached, and state of enlightenment, state of self-realization, then it is all above all those sattva, raja and tama. Mm-hmm. See, the basic three, Vishnu, Brahma, Vishnu and Mahesh are all the symbols of sattva, raja and tama. When you reach the state of which Gautam Buddha reached, then you are all you are above all these states. Then how can you say that you have how pure you are? Means you are actually nothing. You are knowledgeable at the same time you are not knowing anything. Means that is a contradiction.
Where do you get your information about Brahma, Vishnu and Shiva?
Sir, I am hardcore mad of all these topics. I am really I really get fascinated towards all these
yes,
things.
Yes, yes, but where do you get the information?
I read the books of Swami Vivekananda, Swami Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, which tells us that when someone reaches that state, you are above all these things, sattva, raja and tama. The Brahma is the symbol of sattva. Krishna is the symbol of raja. And Mahesh is a symbol of tama. So when you reach the state, actually all these three gods, they are also meditating towards that Almighty.
I understand. So let us take from the Vedas, from the scriptures, what is actually said. Krishna tells in Gita, Traigunya Vishaya Veda Nistraigunya Bhavarjaran Nirvandva Nitya Sattvashro Niyogakshema Atmavan. Krishna tells Arjuna and through Arjuna everyone that the The Vedas mainly deal with the three modes of material nature, sattvaguna, rajaguna, tamaguna. Krishna says you must rise above all these three modes of nature. You must transcend all the three modes of nature. But what happens when you transcend all the modes of material nature? Krishna says, you surrender to me. Vishnu, Om Tad Vishnu Paramam Patap Shata. The Vedas explain that Vishnu is transcendental to this entire cosmic manifestation. Even Shankaracharya taught that. That Narayan is Narayano Paravyakta. He's transcendent to the modes of nature. He's transcendent to the world. He's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Lord Vishnu descends into this world as an expansion, specifically to oversee the mode of goodness. But ultimately, beyond this world, Lord Vishnu is existing eternally in Vaikuntha. And the Vedas describe the planets called Vaikuntha, spiritual planets in the spiritual sky. Yes, there are two realizations of the Absolute. There's the impersonal and the personal. And they're both true. It just depends on what we aspire for. For those who want simple impersonal liberation, or what the nirvana of negation of material dualities and suffering, they can enter into the Brahma Jyoti, where the spirit soul just enters as a spark of light. And that spark of light simply exists within the sunlight of the spiritual sky, or the Brahman. You can attain that destination, but Krishna says it's very, very difficult. But within that spiritual sky, there are planets called Vaikuntha, where the Supreme Lord is living as Krishna, as Ram, as Narasimha. In his various forms, he's living in these beautiful planets and engaging in Leela. Leela is not temporary. Leela is not a thing under the modes of material nature. Leela is transcendent. Janma karma chame divyam evam yoveti tatvata tyatva deham punara janma naiti mameti sorjuna. This is the basis of Gita. Krishna says, one who understands the transcendental, divyam, nature of my appearance and activities never takes birth in this material world again. Transcendental means above, beyond the modes of nature. Krishna's birth is transcendent to the three goans of nature. Krishna's lila or activities are eternal and spiritual. They're taking place in the spiritual world. They just descend into this world to attract our hearts again to his loving service. So we have that choice. We can either worship the impersonal aspect of the Supreme and enter into Brahman as a spark within the spiritual sky of light, or we can enter within that spiritual sky the abodes, the Vaikunthas of the Lord, where our eternal, original, natural, spiritual body is resumed or awakened. And we have an intimate, loving relationship with the Supreme, where we can enter into his leelas. One is shanti, or peace. The other is prema, or love. That is our choice. But in Gita, Krishna very strongly, let us say, advertises or encourages us, sarva dharman parityaja mam ekam sharanam vraja. Abandon all varieties of religion. Surrender to the Supreme Truth. Bhaktya tvananiya shakya aham evam vidorajana gyatam drastam cha tatvena pravesham cha parantapa. Krishna says it is only through bhakti, it is only through loving devotional service that I can be understood as I am standing here before you. So yes, they are both right. You can achieve the impersonal existence of the Lord and attain peace, or you can attain the loving service of the Lord, and that is ananda, or love. So we can never become God. We could be a little spark within the impersonal existence of the Lord, or we can enter into the eternal pastimes of the Lord. But becoming God, either you're God or now you're not God. Avajananti mamudha manusintaram ashrita. Krishna Supreme. God never forgets he's God. We are eternal servants of God. And that is real humility, to understand I'm eternally servant of God. And to serve God means to be an instrument of God's will, of God's love in everything we do in our life. And to have that positive aspiration, we can overcome every possible obstacle. In Srimad Bhagavatam, and I'll end the class with this little narration. Dhruva Maharaj was just a 5-year-old boy. And he was insulted by his father and stepmother in such a way that was so intolerable. His heart was broken. He was so devastated and anger. He just couldn't even speak to his mother. He was weeping. He was trembling. His mother was brokenhearted. And his mother said, "There's nothing I can do. Your father has another wife besides me and he favors her." Stepmother said, "If you want to sit on your father's lap, you're going to have to take birth in my womb. You're not worthy of him." So Dhruva said, "I want the kingdom of my father. How can I get it?" And his mother said, "Well, if you worship Vishnu, you can attain anything. That's what I have heard." So he went into the forest at 5 years old with so much determination. And Narada Muni came. "If you really are sincere about God, then God sends you guru. By the mercy of Krishna, one gets guru. By the mercy of guru, one gets Krishna." So Narada Muni came and he tested Narada. He said, "Dhruva, you're just a boy. Don't take these things so seriously. Just go home." And Dhruva Maharaj basically said, "Your words do not sit in my heart. I am seeking the Supreme Lord. Tell me how, or else stand aside." So Narada Muni told him, "You chant the names Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. You chant the name of God. You worship the form of the Lord. And you perform these austerities." And he did it. So much determination. 5-year-old boy. And Lord Vishnu, in his deep meditation, he saw the beautiful, super excellent, all merciful, beautiful form of God within his heart. And then he opened his eyes and saw that the Lord was standing outside of himself. He wanted to offer prayers, beautiful prayers of gratitude and love, but he was uneducated. So the Lord touched his head with his conch shell and empowered Dhruva to recite such beautiful prayers that even today, millenniums later, we're reading and praying according to Dhruva's prayers. He became completely self-realized. And the Lord told him to go back home and cooperate with his family. And he became the king. Haribo. And he was a king for a long time. And when it was time, a beautiful airship from the spiritual world descended to bring him, not to the Brahmajyoti, but to Vaikuntha. To be in the loving service of the Lord eternally. It is beyond mukti. Prema is beyond mukti. And Dhruva Maharaj said, "I can't go. What about my mother? My mother, that poor innocent lady, she's the one that inspired me on the path of devotion. I can't leave without her." And they pointed upward, and he saw that she was already before him on her way to Vaikuntha. When you become pure in your heart, in devotion to God, that all of your loved ones and friends, they receive the benefit of God's grace. So when he was about to step on the airship, death personified became the step that he stepped upon to board the plane. Even death itself becomes a very, very positive stepping stone to our ultimate destination if we have faith, if we have realization based on the power of a positive service attitude. Thank you very much. The grace of Goddess Durga. It's the Navaratri season, so we're allowed to chant till 11 o'clock. But we won't chant till 11 o'clock, but we can chant a little later than usual. I would like to sincerely thank all of you very much. Please do take this humble offering of whatever words I have tried to speak to heart. A positive attitude in life with proper faith and association can definitely help us overcome all obstacles and find real happiness and offer others real happiness. The chanting of God's names actually fills our consciousness with the supreme, most positive energy of God's presence and God's grace. So now let us chant together. Thank you very much.